Good evening, and welcome to this evening's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Karen Kiefer, a member of the International Relations Member-Led Forum, and your chair for this evening. We also welcome our listeners on the radio, and we invite our audience to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers. Julie R. Dargis, the blonde over there, is based in Minneapolis, which is in Minnesota. She was a Peace Corps volunteer in Morocco and later spent 20 years working in Central Africa and Eastern Europe with populations affected by war and natural disaster. For many years, she was a humanitarian aid worker in some of the most difficult and dangerous countries in the world. Her book, Pit Stop in the Paris of Africa, answers the question, what is it like to live and work as a humanitarian aid worker? Julie will be joined in conversation with Kitty Thurmer, the lady in the red blouse, who is a Peace Corps volunteer in Mali.
The brunette.
Brunette, yeah. We can never tell these days.
I used
sure,
to be the brunette.
Yeah. Kitty has lived and worked in seven countries in Europe, Africa, Asia, and the Caribbean. And she is one of the Return Peace Corps volunteer group's finest writers that we have. Now I'd like to welcome you welcome to the podium Julie Dargis and Kitty Thurmer.
Thank you, Karen. Here I am at the podium for those of you listening. I just want to say, first off, it's a delight to be here. I'm absolutely honored. And there are so many wonderful people, great friends, great colleagues, longtime compatriots in the humanitarian world. And thank you all for coming. I'm so delighted. I think what I'll do is just ask Kitty to let you know what we have planned for you, and then we'll just take off. So, Kitty?
Thank you, Julie. It's very simple. It's right out of the scriptures, actually. There'll be a first reading, then three questions, a second reading, three questions, and then a grand finale. And then if there's time, and there will be, we'll have a conversation going. And I know that one of you in the audience who will remain nameless had suggested we do the questions at first, but we didn't want to risk having you guys hijack our show from the beginning. So I'd like Julie to start with the first reading. Thank you.
Oh, my. The first reading is from the second chapter, which is interesting since the first chapter is in the beginning, but... The first reading is dedicated to all of you Peace Corps people in the audience. A second-year volunteer from a neighboring town arrived for a visit. I had been in Teredon for 2 months, and my Arabic language was still minimal. During training, we had received 3 months of technical, cultural, and language training. Early on, I was placed in a group that was to become the most proficient in Arabic. After a week, I was sent to a lower level. At the end of our pre-service training, we were tested for Arabic proficiency using the State Department rating scale of 0 to 5. Most volunteers hovered around a rating of 2. I was given a 0 plus, the lowest rating in the group. You have absolutely no grammar and very limited vocabulary, the test read told me after the oral exam, but you can communicate, so I'm going to pass you. I had answered most of his questions with my hands. I walked with the second-year volunteer to the local Hanout to buy provisions for lunch. I went to the small grocery store to buy fresh bread, butter, Coca-Cola, and yogurt every day on my way home from school. I ordered the items in Arabic. I paid the shopkeeper and turned to leave. In a bid to impress the second-year volunteer, I twisted my body toward the shopkeeper and thrust the large bottle of Coca-Cola into the air. "How am in bed, inshallah," I said. Three old men sitting on large bags of rice against the wall of the shop grabbed their turbans in unison, laughing as they mimicked the phrase. I smiled broadly, proud of my proficiency. Wahalela libriti, as you wish, miss, the shopkeeper said. As soon as we were out of earshot, the second-year volunteer looked over at me. Do you know what you just said? Yeah, I replied. I told him that I would bring back the empty bottle. He's so nice, he never makes me pay the deposit. Did you know that there are three H's in Arabic? He asked. I looked back at him, hoping to be tutored. Second-year volunteers often mentored newly arrived volunteers, translating words, teaching vocabulary, and providing grammar tips. He spit out three sounds. The first sound emanated from the back of his throat. You used the wrong one, he explained. Oh, then what did I say? I asked. You just told him you would have sex with him later. When I had begun to frequent the store, there had not been anyone other than me and the shopkeeper when I made my purchases. As the weeks progressed, there wasn't a day that I had not seen at least three old men sitting against the inside wall of the shop after I arrived after school. I was wondering why he hadn't invited me to lunch with his family, I said. Now I know why.
I love that story, Julie, and I'm sure many of you returned Peace Corps volunteers have similar tales of humiliation, not even at the beginning of your service, but throughout, perhaps. And although my story is not as sexy as yours, it reminds me of when I was working for Catholic Relief Services in Madagascar back in the day, and someone asked me where the medicines were, and I said in my best Hindi high French that les médecins sont dans le frigo. The doctors are in the refrigerator. And that was the end of my career there. My question for you, Julie, to kick things off, and we did not rehearse this, so this is going to, you know, freak her out that she hasn't heard this question from me yet. When you recruit talent for development projects overseas, it's kind of like a card game. Anyone want to trade a left-handed engineer from the Marshall Islands for a disability expert from Burkina Faso? Yet one of the top skills needed that you won't find on a resume is a PhD in a sense of humor. And having served in places like Rwanda and Sarajevo, Julie, and for those of you who have read the book, it's the humor is what keeps things together. How do you stay sane? How do you keep your humor when you're going to funerals of your staff every day?
Well, I don't find it humorous at the funerals. And for those of you who have read the book, there are some very touching moments in my life when I've had to be in places out of respect. But that being said, I think, you know, my mother taught me well. She taught me to respect folks, and if somebody dies, you show up and you pay your condolences. And if I go back, I have a sister in the audience here. I'm from a very funny family. I'm not very funny myself compared to some of my siblings and my brother, who's hysterical. And that's always been really delightful to grow up in a place where, you know, there was kind of that joy, even with the trauma. But in terms of humor, I appreciate and I'm glad that I have humor, because I enjoy making jokes in different languages. So I've worked and many of you in this audience here have worked with me overseas, and you know that I'll treat the driver and the receptionist as much as the president of a country, because I really love connection and I love to connect to people and try to make them laugh. And even as a director, I would often try to make jokes. And I think that what it does is it breaks the tension. And I don't know if that must be a natural thing, but if that's my PhD, then I'm happy that I graduated.
You well earned, my friend. Thank you. Sometimes being a writer can mean being a split personality. As Picasso once said, first you eat the fruit and then you paint it. My question is, were you a writer first and foremost, and then suppressed it while you were doing humanitarian work overseas, or were you scribbling all along and then finally took the time to pull it all together when you got home?
I think I've always been a writer, but I never knew it. And when I was young, I used to wake up with ideas for short stories. I'd say, oh, that'd be a great short story, but I just let it go out of my mind because I wasn't a writer. And then when I was in the Peace Corps, I had this wonderful boyfriend, and he asked me to write him a sonnet. And I said, fine. And I went off and I wrote a poem that had nothing to do with iambic pentameter. And I came back and he said, well, that doesn't have iambic pentameter. And I said, fine, I'll go make it happen. And I did. And I wrote the boyfriend sonnet. And I really enjoyed the process of working within the constraints of a sonnet with the three stanzas and the couplet and the different rhyming patterns. And I found some solace there. So I wrote quite a bit in 87, 89 when I was in the Peace Corps. And then later I continued to write, but I didn't tell anybody. I shared that first sonnet. And I don't think I really shared any other poetry after that. Over the years, I might kind of throw a poem to somebody and say, what do you think? And, you know, because I think for those of you that are like me, that you don't see yourselves as writers, yet you have plenty to say and you've written plenty of journals or poems or short stories, what happened over the years is I was looking to others to validate me. And when I finally found that I, when I was ready to write, what I did was I took all my poems, I wrote 40 sonnets in 6 or 7 countries, and I always knew that one day I would publish them. I just knew it. And I always knew that I would then dedicate it to the person who asked me to write the first sonnet. So that was in my mind for years. And then I got back from South Sudan three, four years ago, and I said, it's time. And I sat down and I wrote the introduction, which was a thank you to the person that asked me to write the sonnet. And then I just continued to write the book. So the idea was to write where I was and what I was doing on one page and the sonnet on the other to put it into context. And I did that. And then when I put it out to readers, nobody liked the poetry. They wanted more story. Everybody liked the story. And that's when I quit my job then and wrote the book. And when I had put it out, again, I was still looking for others to give me the validation that I was a writer. But when I finally decided to write the book, then I just decided that I read a book about writing nonfiction, and there's one piece of advice that stuck with me so much, and it said, trust your material. So what I did was I simply, if I didn't know where I was going or what I was doing, I simply trusted the material. And I think what I found is I was a relentless self-editor. And sometimes, I don't know how you may write, but I see people write where they will write something and say, that's it. But for me, that's not even anything. And when I started to write essays, I would write and write and write, and then I would throw away the first 2, 3, 4, 5 paragraphs, and if I trusted the material, it's amazing the journey you go on. And the story tells itself. And I think the only other thing I want to say is that many people in this room are in the book. You're either named or there's a reference to something that we did together, and I didn't name you. And it wasn't because of out of disrespect. It's just that the story tells itself. The story creates itself. And I'm, as a poet, I'm so honored to be a channel that ideas can come through me. And now as a writer, I'm just so happy to just be on my own and not worry about what other people think.
Great. Speaking of storytelling, you're a natural, as an Italian-American, you're a natural-born storyteller, Julie, both in your life and in your sonnets and in your conversation. We all know that and enjoy that, and now in your writing. And is there a place in your mind for longer-form storytelling, as you've done in your nonfiction book, in this age of tweets?
Well, funny you should ask that, Kitty. And she didn't share these questions with me. You're killing me over here. I'll tell you what I did, and I may not even answer your question, but I do want to say this. So when I wrote the book, I decided, all right, I'm traumatized. I'm writing this book, and I'm remembering things that happened in Rwanda, and I'm traumatized. I'm also having a great time laughing about some things that I can't believe. So it was a wonderful experience. And what I wanted to do was, I said, when I'm done with this book, this is my story, and I'm healed. You know, I feel happy. I strengthened the relationship with my mother through the process of writing the book. I learned so much about myself, and I learned about writings. That's all really cool. But what I thought was, if people are also traumatized, like I am, because many of the friends that had gone through things with me, I want to give them a place where they can go to dump their baggage. So I thought, okay, I don't want them to tweet, and I don't want them to click like on Facebook. So what can I do to provide a venue for people if they want to tell their own stories? And so I just looked around and I found Tumblr. And what I liked about Tumblr is you can put a quote or a picture or a video or a story, and it's just very easy. And so I set it up while I was writing, and it's like pissed up in the Paris of Africa on the Tumblr. And it's not my blog, it's the book's blog. And so what I do is I just would once a week while I was still writing in production, I'd put something up there. And subsequently, I think three or four people have sent me things, and I just post it. And that, you know, so I don't think that in any way, shape, or form answers your question, but I think there is a place for storytelling. I'm so happy now, and I'm so relieved that I had this opportunity to write this book because I got a lot out of my system that was holding me back for many, many years. And I think that what I learned about the process was, you know, we should all tell our stories. I have a book that's great, and I'm really delighted about it, but what I really have is a much closer relationship with my mother, and I never would have got that had I not written the book.
Thank you. And following on the tweet remark before we get to your second reading, Karen reminded us here in Silicon Valley land, wherever we are, that when we meet again, we'll be wearing Google glasses, and who needs storytelling when it's all digitized in front of your eyeballs, and when you meet a stranger, you'll know that you were in Samoa because it's written there in front of your eyes. So can't wait for that. Stay tuned. And now I invite Julie to do her second reading, please.
What I wanted to do for the second reading is I wanted to read two of the sonnets from the Balkan years. Most of the stories are from Africa, and most of the prose are from Africa. But I did spend 5 years in the Balkans, and with me today is Vanya Peradinovich Robinson, my colleague from there. And I invited her to join me here because she was such a great part of the life. We worked together under very difficult circumstances. And what's interesting is what I want to tell you is I published a reader's guide for you because I was coming here and I'm so honored to be here. So I published a reader's guide with questions, and I reached out to people who had been in the countries where I had been, and I asked them to write their stories. And out of five people, three people answered. And so we'll give it later. And Vanya's daughter actually wrote an essay. She was 9 years old during the bombing, and she wrote an essay in the story. So what I'd like to do now is read a very short reading, two sonnets and some notes. The first sonnet is called The Promise of Peace, and it was written in Sarajevo in 1999. The blast threw me off of my feet. As I rose, you fell to your knees. My blood burns like flames on the street. Shards of glass blind my eyes, but I see. Extended hand, lay down your arms. 3 winters for springs have gone by. River of life, spit out your charms. Wash the tears that I no longer cry. Fresh fallen snow covers torn leaves. Moss weaves a carpet of fleece. Smooth rounded stones, symphonic reprieve from the source, flows the promise of peace. Voices call out, the current is strong, fill my lungs, Sarajevo, with song. I was evacuated from Belgrade 3 times. I write about it in the book. That's one of my favorite chapters, actually. That's the funniest chapter, even though I was evacuated. But we had a lot of fun when I was there. And after the 3rd time, the story was always that the 1st time I was more concerned about my colleagues. The 2nd time we were equally concerned about each other, and then the 3rd time I was more concerned about myself. It was a very interesting journey. I went back. A year later, I went back to see Vanya and my 2 other colleagues just to say hello. I was still working in the region. I'm going to read a very, very short intro to a poem that I wrote when I went back. The poem is called Blind Return, and what I do in the book is I write notes on some of the sonnets, and I wanted to share this because it really brings true to home. In the aftermath of the bombing, I returned to the city where I had taken up temporary residence the year before. It was during this visit that I wrote the sonnet Blind Return. Prior to settling into the popular Central Cafe on the main boulevard to write, I strolled down the side street where my former office had been located. As I neared the entryway to the building, my eyes fell upon a man leaning against the cement wall, his head shaded by the Juliet balcony above him. His arms, draped securely on top of his crutches, hung loosely at his sides. As I approached him, I grabbed his outstretched arm. We expressed a warm greeting to each other through our eyes. After a few moments, I placed a few bills in his palm and bid him farewell. I visited my former colleague in her downtown apartment. She recounted reports of uranium-tipped bullets burrowed within the rubble along the main boulevard. The hair on my arms bristled as I remembered the T-shirt that my father had worn in the early 70s. Across the front of the T-shirt, block letters had read, "Long rods, do it better." My father had been a setup man at a munitions plant in Minneapolis. For years, he wore a sensor taped inside the interior of his wedding band. The sensor was removed and tested for exposure to uranium on a monthly basis. More than a quarter of a century later, I contemplated the possibility that my father had had a hand in the manufacture of the long rods that lay fallow in the rubble along the streets of Belgrade, their uranium tips forever gleaming in the heart of the city that I had been forced to flee. Blind Return. East crossing west at Two Rivers, a crux. Rubble on curbsides, torn windows and walls. Bleeding of hearts, blind return, left in flux. From gleaming tips, long rod bullets, life falls. Turning back time with the skin of bare hands, life is worth living, although it is lost. Headstones on hillsides, on still, fertile lands. Fruit of late harvests at double the cost. Vapid the sidewalks, death-treading cement. Sky-colored canopies float on thin air. Pebbles on footsteps, a waltz of lament. Fingers stir foam in cracked cups as I stare. Brandy in goblets, grilled kilos of meat. Dried plums distilled from my tears, bittersweet.
Thank you, Julie. Story about your father and the rods and what that means reminds me of my own late father, who happily lived until 92. But as of about age 60, the U.S. government was sending him regular letters asking if he was still alive, because he had been, as a Navy man, on a boat that had witnessed, no joke, the nuclear explosion on Bikini Atoll, and that killed animals that were on that ship. But happily, he escaped that. So there's always a history to what's going on with our parents that we're not always aware of. One of my favorite quotes of yours is, "Throughout my travels, my heart crossed many borders." I like that. And there's a lot about healing and heart in your book, Julie, and in the sonnets as well. And I guess you've started to answer this question a little bit. Why did you write this book? To help yourself heal and to help others heal?
The best part about writing this book, I already told you about why. I didn't know why I wrote it. I just wrote it, and this wonderful thing happened. And then there's a woman that I worked with in two countries. She was an emergency nurse for over 30 years in Canada. And I hired her, and she was a field coordinator up in Chad in a very remote place. So what happened was she bought the book, and she read it, and she called me, and she said, "Julie, I was thinking about the time when the rebels jumped over our wall and put a gun to my head, and I couldn't, and I wanted to write about it. So I joined my husband in Indonesia, and I tried to write about it, and I couldn't. I just would cry and cry. And then I bought your book, and I read it. I didn't sleep for 3 nights. I woke up the third day. My mind was clear, and I began to write."
Wow.
And I had actually been the country director when this happened to her. Some similar things had happened to me, and I wasn't aware that she had been so traumatized by this event. And what I talk, if sometimes I go to university classes and things like that, and I say, you know, how we would manage the trauma You know, there are people that are with the military that are debriefed and get extensive support in counseling. But what happened to me and with my colleague is we just say this: "You okay? Yeah. You?" And it's nothing more than that. And then we continue on in these very difficult circumstances doing this work. So I was so happy that I was able to touch somebody, and I would love to find an audience like with women vets or people that have post-traumatic shock. I came back with post-traumatic shock after Rwanda. Did I know what it was? No, but I stumbled on a guy that helped me, and I would go and see him, Jim Moore. He's in the book. He allowed me to use his name. I'd go. He used to work with Vietnam vets. I'd go and see him anytime something happened to me. I would self-manage my trauma, because not in one single instance did anyone ever kind of reach out to me. And then I would, and then obviously I didn't help my colleagues as well. And what's interesting is I met somebody for drinks not too long ago, an old boss of mine, and she said, "Julie, after you were in Chad, I asked that, you know, you get a debriefing. Did that ever happen?" And I said, "No, but thank you." Thank you for thinking of me. I did go to see the guy that I always see. So I think one of the things that I would like out of this book is I would like us to start having this conversation in our business of humanitarianism, where we start to support each other and we start to understand. I don't have a problem that I had post-traumatic shock. I understand why it happened to me, and I'm just so thankful that I was able to stumble on someone that could help me over the years. But I don't want others to be stumbling, because the world is getting much more difficult. We're in the line of fire much more often in the last 6, 7, 8 years than we used to be. And so we need to look at this. So perhaps, you know, it's a secondary purpose for the book, but if it helps anybody to feel better and to connect, you know, to themselves and say, "Oh, somebody else understands. I'm not alone in this." That's pretty great.
That's wonderful, and it does remind me of the nurse's memoir from Vietnam, where she was marching with the Vets Against the War in front of the White House, huge rally, and they told her to step aside, because if Nixon's people saw that there were women there, they would think that they were not legitimate vets and that they were trying to beef up the crowd. Can you imagine? And her problem was exactly what you've identified, that there was no support for her as a female vet, and for, say, humanitarian workers, that might be a call to action of some kind. I'm going to skip one of the questions and move on to... Everybody has a story. Not everybody wants to write their story, but many of you might be interested in the mechanics and the incredible fortitude that it took Julie, as I watched her not only overseas live this life, but then come back and pull it out and not only write about it, but go the extra mile and have all kinds of ancillary things come out of it, which she can describe. So I wanted you to talk a minute, Julie, before your final reading, and then we can open it up. You not only wrote the book, you took the courses, you learned how to publish, you edited it yourself multiple times, you published it, you created a website, you created a marketing video with the help of Kathleen, your sister, who's here tonight, you created a community, inviting others to join in this effort, and if you can talk about that process. Did you always imagine that, or did one thing lead to another?
I had no idea. I suppose I can't swear on the radio, but I mean, the reason that I wrote the book, I was so pissed off. You know, I went to a poetry conference in Minneapolis, and I was so excited to go to the seminar of the publishers, because Minneapolis is a wonderfully rich. Publishing community. And so there were three editors from literary magazines and books, you know, small publishing firms. And I said one question. I said, "What can somebody like me do, who already has a manuscript, to access resources like design for a cover and editing and marketing tips?" And one of the guys looked at me and he said, "Did you come in late?" And I thought, well, there's only eight of us here, and I'm in the front, so no, I didn't come in late. So I said, oh, okay, fine. So I said, I'll just go start my own publishing house. And that's what I did. It was really interesting. Within a week, then one of the big seven publishers in New York bought a small publishing house, and there are so many resources. So I started a website called Indie House Press. I just went online. I had time. You know, I went online and I bought the name. And then I started, it's like my story, because anybody who I talked about independent publishing, then I would just have put their references on my website. So it's not like I scanned and got all of these different things. I just, people that touched me and helped me, I did that. Kinney Thiel was one of the first people. She said, I had a book, and if you had a book that was self-published or independently published, I put it on the website, and it was wonderful. So that's how it started. And then I think that for everybody does have a story, and many of you want to publish that, your stories, and you can. And that's what I say on Indie House Press. You can. You can do it for no money. But I think that as I said to Kitty, even though I didn't know the questions, like a good Italian sauce, there's two things you use, garlic and olive oil. If you want to publish independently, you have the story, publish away, but there's two things that you must do, and that's a professional cover and professional editing. Otherwise, don't publish, because I think you're doing yourself a disservice. And I think that there are so many resources out there. And what I found is when I went to, then I kept going to a lot of these seminars. There's an Independent Book Publishing Association in Minneapolis. I'm currently in D.C. now, but I was there for many, many years. And I'd say, I have this nonprofit website to support independent writers. And they'd say, oh, that's refreshing, because in the market, you have all of these small businesses trying to make money off of writers. And for those of us that self-publish, we have to invest in everything, and we have to make decisions about what the services we buy and when we put it out and what we do. And we can all do that, but we need to be careful about that, so... I think that in a nutshell is how, you know, I was pissed off, so I did it myself.
Good for you. And we're going to give a little shout out before your final reading to Marion Beale. Would you raise your hand, Marion Beale? Yeah. Marion Beale is extraordinary. She and her working partner, John Coyne, have over the last 30 years created a Peace Corps writer community. Many of you are familiar with it, and if you have your manuscript dusted in the bottom of your drawer, please give it to Marion, and maybe she can publish it also. But it's www. Peace Corps Worldwide. Is that it? Peace Corps Worldwide.org. If you haven't seen it, it's an extraordinary resource with wonderful blogs and so on. So I'd like to ask Julie for her final reading, and then we'll open it up for some comments or rants or questions.
Thank you, Kitty, and yeah, Marion, I just think you're wonderful. For many, many, many years, anybody who's, I think there was the Peace Corps Writers, Readers and Writers, and that's what Marion and John put together more than 20 years ago, because when I lived in Washington, I think I wrote a couple of things for them. But what they did was they really did make a community, because it wasn't about the writers, it was about the readers as well. And so we're all partners in this together. What I'd like to do is just close the program, and thank you again for your questions, Kitty. I'd like to close the program with the author's note from the end of the book, which is what I wrote when I was done with the book. The question that so many people ask me when I return from overseas is, what was it like? The first time that I was asked this question, I was newly returned from Morocco, and it was a struggle to sum up over 3 years of my life in one sound bite. More than 25 years later, I will attempt to sum up my experiences in one page. Readjustment became easier. I found that I could slide comfortably between cultures when I stopped wanting the place where I was to be someplace different. I learned that if I focused on the unique aspects of each place, I didn't pine after what I did not or could not have. There were times when I was away when I pushed myself too hard. I paid for my experiences with exhaustion and illness, including malaria, more than once. I paid for my experiences with splintered, disjointed relationships, but I did not pay for my experiences in sorrow. I have gained so much from my international travels. The lessons have been many, but the themes have been few. Through my travels, I learned that people want a better life for themselves and their children. They want to feel safe and secure. They want to live their lives with respect and dignity. But most of all, people want to be loved. The people I have met around the world have taught me that, notwithstanding our many cultural differences, at our very core, we are all the same. Thank you. Thank you, Julie.
Our thanks to Julie Dargis and Kitty Thurmer for their very interesting discussion conversation this evening. I'm Karen Kiefer, a member of the club's International Relations member-led forum. Please raise your hands if you have a question so we can pass the microphone around. In the meantime, we'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Pit Stop in the Paris of Africa with author Julie Dargis in conversation with Kitty Thurmer. Okay, first of all, before we take questions, I'd like to say, in regard to coming back after 2 years in Peace Corps, I was in Nigeria and Liberia in the 60s. My family would say, tell us all about it. And I'd say, it was the most incredible, life-changing experience I've ever had. And they'd say, fine, would you like some coffee? Let me tell you about Betty up the road, you know. And it was like nobody wanted to listen. So being able to get your story out, and we all have stories, whether we've stayed here in the States and just encountered people in our neighborhood or on the streets, or whether we've had the privilege to experience other cultures. So I really appreciate that, and also knowing how to get the story out. So we're ready to take questions. First question.
Thank you. Could you talk a little bit about your experience in Morocco?
Did you want me to say what it was like?
And then have coffee?
Yeah, well, you know, what I say about Morocco, I loved being a Peace Corps volunteer. I loved every minute of it. And when I think back, I remember walking down the narrow way, alleyways, following a kid with the sheep, and I was, you know, and then he might be wearing the coat that I had from 1977. Somehow it found its way to him, or the T-shirt that my brother used to wear. Somehow it found its way there. But I just loved the light and the culture, and I was a teacher, and I think for those of you who are teachers, it doesn't matter where you're a teacher, but it was the most human thing I ever did in my life. It's so raw. You're with kids and you're connected to them in such a cool way. I loved it. What I learned is that I had a knack for writing lesson plans, and I never knew if I was a good teacher or not, but I was a great disciplinarian in it. So I was known for my class control, and I actually extended a third year to be a volunteer leader to go around helping other teachers to learn class control. Many years later, I worked for with refugees. And I talk about that in the book, and I always say it was my paid Peace Corps, because then it was very similar, but it was, you know, I was paid for one thing, and I always had a shower and clean water, and that was nice, but what was similar was the connection that I had with the local staff, so I highly recommend it for anyone, but it was wonderful. That's what it was like.
Yeah. Julie, thank you. I've done things like this also. And my question to you is, in the light of the violence and the Islamic extremism, are there some countries which you would exclude?
Myself?
From your service?
Well, I guess, let's see, 2 years ago I was in Somalia, Pakistan, and Darfur, three of perhaps the worst places for an American woman with blue eyes to be. No, so the answer is no. I did go to Afghanistan, and that's when I got caught, because my mother knew about it, because she used to say, they would never send you to a place that's not safe, would they? And I said, no, they wouldn't. And then I went to Afghanistan, and I was caught. I haven't been to Iraq, though one of my closest friends will be going there very soon as the mission director, and I would love to get a short gig there, and things are very different there. One of the things that concerns me, and maybe why I was always so exhausted when I came home, I had a lot of responsibility for my colleagues, and I took it very seriously. And so I did a lot of training on security. One of my favorite organizations since I was in Rwanda is Doctors Without Borders, Medecins Sans Frontières. The organizations that I work with don't like it when I say that, but I love them, and I know Lisa, we work together in Rwanda. They go in, they go out, they save lives, and they do it as safely as they can. But many of my close friends from Doctors Without Borders are being faced with seeing their colleagues being shot and killed. And it's just very difficult. And they have left some countries because of security, which is really a shame, because then people that need it don't get necessary services. One of the things that I say, and for those of you who know, Chris Stevens was a volunteer in Morocco the year before I was there. And in the book that I'm going to give you tonight, there's a current Peace Corps volunteer called Melanie Comblat who went to his site and wrote a beautiful, beautiful tribute to him. And what I say is we take incredible risks. And I know that my family and my friends don't like that. And now that I'm kind of safely home and I've kind of quit the hard work about 2 or 3 years ago, I promise you, I read this book and I don't know who that person is. I can't believe the incredible risks that I took. But I can also tell you, and especially in the case of Rwanda, which was one of the most difficult experiences of my life, I don't regret a minute of it. Not a minute. I learned so much, and I have such an admiration for people. And that's what kept me going. I tried to be as safe as I could. I was very, and as a woman and a single woman, I was very careful, very, very careful, and I was also very lucky. And I know that. And that's why at the end of the book, I talk about getting in a roadblock where I broke a toe, and the only thing that I remember that went through my mind was, this can go horribly wrong. And then I knew it was over for me. I needed to stop taking those risks. But what I would like is for the humanitarian work, it's important work, that we continue to do it professionally and we continue to try to find ways to increase the security. And we have to make decisions sometimes. And there are very creative ways that we have come to be able to do this by working by remote management. We can also work with local groups that aren't targeted. There are many ways that we've been changing the way that we work, because what's important is the work. And we need to find creative ways to be able to do it.
When I worked in Peace Corps headquarters, so many people that have served overseas did not want to come back here to this country. The cultural shock that we were trained about in training was not going to those countries, but returning to America and seeing all the money and waste and the existence that people have versus knowing what life is all about. I personally would like to return. My kids are overseas now. My daughter stole the grandkids and went to Jakarta, and my son's in Kabul right now. They don't intend on ever living in the United States again, except with their U.S. Agency for International Development tour. They're having to come back to America for a year every so often, after every two tours. And I plan on moving overseas when I retire from retirement. Do you guys ever plan on going back overseas, the two of you, and living? If so, where? And what do you want to do? Or do you think you can do more here in the States to help the people that are so dear to us overseas?
Well, I grew up overseas, and one of our early tours was in Ghana, West Africa, during the time of Kwame Nkrumah, 50 years ago, don't tell anyone. And I recently returned this summer, and what was shocking was going past the U.S. Embassy, where my father had served many years ago, and it was open architectural wonder and glass and so on, and then circling back not too far away, the Fortress America, our U.S. Embassy. And growing up overseas, you can absorb a lot of anti-Americanism. But my father would remind me from time to time, and he married an immigrant from Iran who had fled her home country. If America's so horrible, why is everybody knocking down the doors to get in? So you've got that to consider. I'll come visit you, Karen, wherever you end up. But it is a complicated world, and what I don't like are the labels that are given. You mentioned Islamic extremism. What does that mean? And I know you've used that just as a point of your conversation, but as a Peace Corps volunteer in Mali, the Islamic extremists took over the north, and who they were and where they came from, it's very complicated. But anyway, what about you, Julie?
When I decided to quit the hard stuff, I went back to Minneapolis, and it was really pretty cool because I ended up traveling quite a bit with a group there internationally. In Minneapolis, we have one of the largest Somali populations. We also have the second largest Hmong population. And I was working a lot in Africa. So what would happen is I'd go and do my gigs in Africa, and then I always say I have my international leg and my Minnesota leg. So I've always been divided that way. These last 4 years, I'm blessed with some parents who are happy and healthy, 80 and 86, and they put me to shame. They run around so much, but I spent 4 wonderful years being closer to them, and that was fantastic. And when I would come home from a gig, I would call the Somali guys that had a taxi company, and I'd say, "So where are you from?" And they'd look at me like, "Oh, this chick is just flying in from Pittsburgh." And they'd ignore me. And I'd say, I don't want to disrespect you, but I'm going to say Eritrea. And they'd say, "How you know that?" And then they would drive down the road, and we'd have these wonderful conversations for the Somalis, because I was in Somalia, and many of them had not been back to Somalia for 20 years. So I said, "Oh, I was just in Galkayo. Oh, my God, it's hot. Can you stand it? It's too hot." Mm-hmm. And they loved it, because then it was a connection. And for me, that's when the world became very small. And so I may or may not go overseas again. I love to travel. I would love to live in a vineyard. I mean, you know, I love, it's so peaceful in vineyards. But right now I'm in D.C. and I'll stick there for a while and work. But I would travel on the turn of a dime, flip of a hat, whatever.
Hi, for the uninitiated, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the process of how you became a Peace Corps volunteer and what led you to your first assignment, I guess, in Morocco.
Well, if you really want the story, it might be, I'll embarrass myself, but one thing I can tell you is that I always loved culture, other cultures, and I always was intrigued. I write about this in my book, you know, even when I write about how I was 10 years old and I was raised Catholic, and the priest was talking about the cows roaming unfettered in India, and I was just so riveted. And whenever we would, I always studied French and any of the Europeans, I invited them home, and manja manja, everybody was welcome in my home. And so I always had this wonderful want to know about other people. So the Peace Corps was very interesting, and what I did was, when I was in college, I threw it in my head, and I said, "Okay, throw it in your head, let it bounce around for a while, and then decide. You have about a year, so then decide what you want to do." So a day came, just like when I was ready to write the book, I said, "I'm ready to apply," and I applied. What's interesting is I had said that I had planted some fish in the backyard with a potato and some dead fish. I did it when I was like 8, and they said, "Agricultural volunteer," and I said, "Oh, no." I know. And so they ended up, I was invited to go to be a teacher in Morocco, and I said, where is that? Which many of us do, and I looked it up and I said, why not? So that's, I think that's probably, there's a lot of heads nodding in the audience. But that's how we did it. It's a love for humanity and interculturalism.
Katie, what about you?
Well, let's hear from others. I think we've got some more. Go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me? You mentioned, Julie, excuse me, you mentioned having post-traumatic stress coming back and working with someone named Jim Miller, I think you said. Is he a psychologist? Was he doing what kind of post-traumatic stress treatment was he doing with you?
Jim Moore.
Moore.
He worked with vets, and again, I write about this in the book. I was sitting at home one day, and I was crying a lot, and it was about Christmas time, and my apartment overlooked the Basilica of St. Mary in Minneapolis, and it was beautiful. Yet every time I looked at the Basilica, I had a visceral reaction. And for those of you that were in Rwanda, as you know, many of the population were killed in Catholic churches. And there's a story about one of my staff who died of AIDS, actually, and it's a very touching story. So I remembered her. I remembered her, and I couldn't get her out of my mind. So I don't know. Sometimes things just happen when you need it. I found this phone book by chance, and I put my finger in it, and I stopped at Jim Moore's name, and it said post-traumatic stress. So I called him. And I think this part of the book is probably one of the best parts of the book for people that have had traumatic experiences. He told me to do three things. He said, when you're ready, find a trinket or something that reminds you of Assumpta. Assumpta is my colleague that died. And then sit down quietly for a minute and then say your goodbyes. Simple, okay? So stress, if anybody has been through stress counseling or grief counseling, I think that's probably one of the basic approaches to grief counseling. So I did that. But when I left when I left him, I wasn't ready. And it took me many weeks until I was ready. And then when I did, it was a beautiful day. I opened up my windows. I dug out a keychain which I brought with me tonight, a keychain that said Uganda, because as you know, the refugees were in Uganda from Rwanda from 1959, which is the year that I was born, and so my colleague went back to Uganda to die in the hospital because it was home to her, even though she was Rwandan. So I had a little keychain and a little note from my colleagues, and I set it down, and I just said, Assumpta, before I say what I need to say to you, is there anything that you want to say to me? And at the very moment, the bells of the Basilica began to ring.
Wow.
And I'll never forget it. And And then that's how I got through that. And then if I had experiences, I had other experiences where people died or something happened, and then I would go back to Jim Moore. And, you know, after a number of years, because I was in a number of countries, what happened the last time after I broke my toe, it was really traumatic. I called him up. I said, Jim, I have to see you. I drove there. I sat down. I broke down. I figured it out in my head while I was breaking down. And then I sat up. He said, you good? I said, yeah, I'm good. You?
I think this is just amazing. There's so many stories. I'd like to hear more about your humanitarian aid work. I've always had the thought that as we get older, like me, when we're retired, that a good thing would be to go to some countries and help them with their voting process or Peace Corps or whatever in dangerous areas, rather than having the young Peace Corps volunteers go to these countries, get kidnapped, raped, whatever, killed, because we're old and we're going to die anyway. So What better way to go? You don't want to go on your sleep. You want to do something good for the world, right? So you can have a better chance getting somewhere, right?
Is that the slogan for the NGO you're going to start? You're going to die anyway. Just come join us.
So what? Tell us some more about...
You know, let me demystify it. Humanitarian work has two words, and the second word is work. It's work. I was a manager, not very sexy. I wrote policies. I did personnel management. I managed fleets. You know, I fired people if they needed to be fired. It was work. I think that there are. I love to do it in a different culture, and I love to do it in French. It was really fun to say, oh, my God, we're doing these meetings in French. But it's work, and I think that it just is the work that I do. I equate it to, I have a lot of friends who work with special needs kids, and I always say to them, oh, you're so cool, you're so great, you're so cool to do this. I could never do this. And they say, but this is what I do, and that's what I say to others. It's just what I do. It's the work that I do. It's the work that I love, and I'm comfortable doing it. And that's the work part. For the volunteer part, there are so many opportunities, and I encourage you all. I mean, many of you were Peace Corps volunteers or other volunteers here. There's many opportunities for you to work in your communities. Even now, tomorrow, you can go and volunteer to read a book to a child or to sit with someone who needs you to be there. Or in a hospice or something. It doesn't matter. There's hundreds of opportunities. It just is what touches you, what speaks to you in doing the work. I just happen to like to do my work in other countries, and I don't shy away, or I'm not probably going to go back too much now on the humanitarian side, you know, because I'm a little bit tired. But for many, many years, I didn't shy away if there was a security issue.
What about you, Kitty?
No, I'm just thinking of the... 75-year-old gentleman, maybe he was 80, who signed up for Peace Corps Mali. This was after my time. And on the health training part, he kept raising his hand, and finally they gave him the microphone. He said, when do we get our box of condoms already? So it's never too late. Anyway, this gentleman had a... go ahead.
Thanks so much for your reading tonight. The intro of your sonnet, you spoke about giving money to a man you met outside your old office.
Yeah.
Obviously, you have a connection to individuals, but in many of your tours, you must have seen suffering and pain at a large scale. How do you balance wanting to impact change across a broad spectrum while seeing individual suffering in front of you?
Well, for anyone who's lived in Africa, you know that people don't suffer. They celebrate life. And it's actually one of the frustrations being a manager, because they don't save. If I started an NGO, it would be to help people do financial management, because they live for today. And that was one of my biggest issues. I cannot say strongly enough how inspired I've been over the years by people who have been have faced such diversity. And children, I love children, and the beauty, the trailer that my sister cut for me has one of the most beautiful pictures of children at the end, and these pictures were taken by someone I worked with in a number of countries, and I look at that trailer and I see those three beautiful kids at the end, and that's what my life is like. I went to a Rotary Club in a state not too long ago, and a man said to me, how can you do this work? How can someone do this work and still have a heart? And I just was so struck by the question, and it was, I don't think I answered it well enough, but what I felt was, I have such a big heart because I've done this work, and I have such an appreciation for populations that are in diversity, and working with refugees was pretty amazing, because I learned just so much about people. And so now I'm pretty relaxed about things, because I don't take things for granted. Anybody who may have gone through cancer, or if you've had a traumatic experience yourself, sometimes we just learn that it's, you know, we can choose to be more relaxed about life, and or we can choose not to. I used to be very uptight, and I hope that I'm not much more. I've known Kitty for many, many years, and It's just such a joy to be with you here. But, you know, I'm much more relaxed now. And again,
it's kinda, the blonde.
Yeah, it's the blonde. Getting back to the book, it really is about telling your story. And because stories are naturally about connection, that if, you know, we read other stories or we tell our own stories, we make those connections. And I have been so honored, and I just cannot say it strongly enough, to have been in so many wonderful communities around the world. And I'm glad that I could write about it because, you know, I want to honor those people by doing it as well.
Our thanks to Julie Dargis and Kitty Thurmer for their very interesting, informative, and emotional discussion this evening. We also thank our audiences here as well as our radio audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.